You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Next month marks the 90th anniversary of one of the most infamous moments in U.S. criminal history, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Seven members and associates of Chicago's Northside Gang lined up against a garage wall and machine gunned. A gruesome moment in the ongoing war between Bugs Moran's Irish gangsters on the north side of Chicago and Al Capone's Italian gang from the South Side, a.k.a. the Chicago Outfit. Both sides battling for power in Chicago during the Prohibition. That massacre is a fitting prologue to the new book, Scarface and the Untouchable, Al Capone, Elliot Ness, and The Battle for Chicago, co-authored by Max Allen Collins and my guest today, Brad Schwartz, who grew up in East Lansing, studied at the University of Michigan, and is now working on his doctorate in American history at Princeton. Brad, welcome. It's so good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
As we're going to hear as we talk about your book, the fact that Al Capone actually spent time in Michigan laying low after a prominent Chicago prosecutor was murdered in 1926. We'll have more on that in a little bit. But first, why tell this story of Capone and Elliot Ness?
Well, it's a story that has become part of American folklore, of course, repeated constantly in films and TV series, most famously the Robert Stack series, The Untouchables, which is based on a memoir that Ness co-wrote near the end of his life about his experiences during the Capone investigation. And because Ness in particular has become such a legend, and films and TV series have really exaggerated what he did beyond any resemblance to the truth. The Brian De Palma film that many people are familiar with spelled their names correctly but didn't get anything else right as far as the history is concerned. There had been a lot of revisionist history that had been written, sort of trying to, I think, put Ness in his place to say that he really didn't have anything to do with Al Capone, that he wasn't that much of a detective. And my co-author and I, who have long, independently of each other, had an interest in this period and had done research on it, really thought that that was a misleading portrait. And so we decided to go back to the archives, go back to the primary sources, and compare what Ness had written in his memoir to what had actually happened. And it turns out he was telling the truth more often than not.
All right. So, and just we should, since you mentioned your co-author, Max Allen Collins, here is someone who knows about crime writing. Tell us a little about what he's done and how the two of you connected.
Well, he is a little bit older than I am. He's a wildly prolific author, a grand master from the Mystery Writers of America. He's written the graphic novel Road to Perdition, which was made into a film starring Tom Hanks several years ago. He's known for his Nathan Heller series of historical detective thrillers, Quarry, which was made into a TV series a couple years back. And growing up as a kid, I loved his work. I still love his work, but reading these historical detective novels that he would write, which are often set in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, really gave me my interest in this period of history. And I went to a book signing of his that he did in Chicago when I was about 15. We hit it off because we have so many of these interests in common. And eventually, as I said, we were so dissatisfied with how people had been getting this history wrong that I said, you know, you're a well-respected novelist, a master storyteller. I was studying at that time at the University of Michigan to be a historian, doing my undergraduate thesis on Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds, which became my first book. So I had a track record as a historian, and I said, we have an opportunity to combine our talents to write the proverbial nonfiction book that reads like a novel.
And that it does, I will tell you right now, Brad Schwartz. So here we have Al Capone, one of America's most famous criminals, Elliot Ness, one of the most famous lawmen, and yet the two had an awful lot in common, starting with the fact both have immigrant parents.
That's absolutely right. Capone's parents were from Italy near Naples. Ness's parents were Norwegian. They both immigrated in the late 19th century. Capone and Ness were born in the United States, but they came from humble beginnings. Their fathers, Capone's father was a barber, Ness's was a baker. And one of the interesting sort of discoveries that we made is that when they're both getting their starts in Chicago, they're living on the same street. That's a long street in Chicago, Prairie Avenue, but they are in houses that are essentially mirror images of each other, these sorts of two flats that you see all over the South Side. Yeah. And although they're not, you know, next-door neighbors necessarily, they are working to professionalize their respective fields, because as Capone is helping bring modern organized crime as we know it today into the world, law enforcement has to respond to that. And so Ness is leading the charge to professionalize, to bring emphasis on education, science, training, to really create this sort of new idea of what a cop or a federal agent should be.
So here were these two men in roughly growing up in the same, as you say, the same street in the same neighborhood in Chicago. So what pulled Capone into life as a criminal and onto the fact that he was such an organized crime boss?
Well, he had, as I said, an example in his father of someone who was making his living an honest way, and Capone seems not to have wanted that side of things. You know, as he's growing up, he's born in Brooklyn. He spends almost the first 20 years of his life there before coming to Chicago, and he... In that sort of environment, you kind of had to join a street gang in order to survive. That didn't mean you were going to be a criminal forever, but Capone very quickly gets pulled into that life. There's the sort of local godfather, whose name is John Torrio, is really the visionary who gets this idea that you can run crime like a business. You can take this new form of corporate capitalism that is being developed around the same time in the early 20th century and apply it to the rackets that had been run in, you know, slums in major cities all over the country. So Capone sees that Torrio can run these rackets and yet can live like a respectable businessman, can go home to his wife at night and be treated as the, you know, the king of the neighborhood. And Capone seems to really have wanted that for himself. And so when Capone has to leave Brooklyn, because he's
things get too hot in Brooklyn.
Exactly, he's got to get out of town. Torrio takes him into Chicago, sort of takes him under his wing, and when I won't spoil
sure.
too much of the story, but when Torrio has to step aside, having already built this sort of organization on the south side of Chicago, Capone comes in to take it over.
And meantime, here's Elliot Ness. How did he wind up following the opposite path?
Well, he loved Sherlock Holmes stories as a child. And I always find it remarkable that those stories are new. They're still being written when Ness is growing up. And Ness had in his own life a real-life Sherlock Holmes as a role model. Like Capone had John Torrio, Ness has his brother-in-law, Alexander Jamie, who worked for what was then known as the Bureau of Investigation, what becomes the FBI. This is even before J. Edgar Hoover comes into it. Jamie is a federal agent. And Ness is attracted to this idea that you can be a professional police officer, you know, in the way that you can be a professional physician or a professional lawyer. He gets the idea that, you know, there's not a whole lot of competition in this field because cops back then didn't need an education. They weren't really trained. You just got a badge and a gun, and that was pretty much it oftentimes.
It was often a first job for new immigrants.
Exactly right.
Irish being a big part of that in New York and Chicago.
Exactly right.
Boston,
and so Ness decides that he can set himself up as this sort of new kind of cop and really make a mark and make a name for himself. And so his brother-in-law takes him into the federal service. They are in the Prohibition Bureau together, which is, of course, notorious for being corrupt. Ness is famous for refusing bribes, and that allows him to sort of rise through the ranks. When the Capone investigation comes around, he's the natural person to give it to. And he's only 27. He's a year younger than I am at that time when he's put in charge of that.
I'm talking with writer Brad Schwartz, whose book Scarface and the Untouchable, Al Capone, Elliot Ness, and the Battle for Chicago, tells. It's the history book that does not feel like you're reading history at all. And as I read this, one of the things, Brad, that really struck me was how criminal activities and gang hits and violence were all over the place in Chicago. I mean, you describe hits and murders and shootouts in great detail and in places that even occasional visitors of Chicago probably have been to. Why was gang violence so out in the open in Chicago, more so than other cities?
Well, you had longstanding corruption within the city of Chicago, particularly on the south side near where the red light district had been for decades before Prohibition comes in. You had gangsters having long-term relationships with police. As you said, these are first-generation Americans oftentimes on both sides. These are guys who have cops and gangsters who come from the same neighborhoods, who know each other, who are sort of following parallel paths toward the American dream. And so there was a lot of corruption, that was what Torrio really brought to this organization. He had these relationships with law enforcement, with local politics, so that when Prohibition comes in and there is this flood of new money because of the illicit liquor traffic, something that a lot of people, you know, who wouldn't think of breaking a federal law in any other context are very much interested in having, that's alcohol. Torrio can take this infrastructure that he's built and apply it to the liquor traffic and make a lot of money very quickly. But when you have any growth industry, there's a lot of people who want to get in on the ground floor as well. And of course—
And there's pushback.
Exactly. And if you're dealing outside the law, we quote Clarence Darrow in the book saying that, you know, if you can't take your competition to court, sooner or later somebody's going to pull a gun. So you had this warfare, what they call the beer wars, over these massive profits. And what ends up helping Capone and his organization come out on top is because they professionalized before the competition. The Northside Gang, they were criminals of the old school. They were still, you know, blowing safes or doing holdups while they were also hijacking liquor trucks or whatever. Capone and his men decide, well, we're going to be more professional than the competition. And that's both in the production and distribution and sale of alcohol, and also in how they are going to eliminate the competition. So something like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre is the pinnacle, really, of this new sort of very professionalized mode of assassination that Capone's men pioneered.
Indeed. And before the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, things got hot for Capone when a prosecutor got caught in a hail of bullets. He was killed. Is that what brought Capone to Michigan in the summer of 1926?
He had been in and out of Michigan quite a bit before that, it seems like. This had been a cooling off point for him. A lot of liquor, as we know, gets shipped from over the Detroit River through Detroit. The Purple Gang were heavily involved into that. And I've heard evidence that Capone and the Chicago outfit had arrangements to import liquor. So Capone had spent time in Michigan before. But as you said, in the spring of 1926, an assistant prosecutor named William McSwiggin, who had a reputation in Chicago of being a crusading prosecutor and a real young hero, was in a place where he should have been, outside a speakeasy with some gangsters who he wasn't interested in prosecuting, apparently. And there was a drive-by shooting with a Thompson submachine gun, and he was killed. And there were some indications that Capone actually pulled the trigger. Certainly we know that his men were involved in the killing. And this is one of these first sort of firestorms of controversy where they took the lid off of the sort of corrupt nexus of crime and politics in Chicago, and Capone is revealed sort of as one of these people who is really corrupting the city. And so he disappears, flees to Lansing, where he had some fellow Italians who could take him in, and he spends the summer of 1926 here. And it's sort of a crossroads moment for him because he can flee the country, he can go to Canada, he doesn't have to go back to Chicago. He's certainly, I think, bit off more than he could chew, because when he's getting into the gang life, he doesn't know that in 10 years he's going to, you know, have his face on the cover of Time magazine, be one of the most famous people in the world. It's because of Prohibition and all of this money that nobody could have anticipated that he becomes this sort of captain of industry. So it's not, even though he chose this life, this is more than he ever would have bargained for. So he doesn't have to stick in it. But eventually he decides he's going to go back. He's going to sort of legitimate himself by force of personality, by giving himself up to the people as a public figure and essentially saying, you know, sure, I'm a bootlegger, but you all drink, so what's the problem? And that's what he does. And he doesn't get charged for this murder or any others, and goes on to become a major captain of industry. And just as a coda to that, the story is the dead prosecutor's father, who had been a cop, supposedly found himself in the same room with Al Capone with ideas of taking revenge, because he, you know, the legal system had failed him by that point. And the story is that Capone said, if you think I did it, shoot me. And the guy couldn't kill him in cold blood, and that was the end of that.
Wow. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre, when I stop and think about reading the description at the beginning of the book, is stunning as far as how violent the deaths were, how ruthlessly efficient the Thompson submachine guns were, and no one ever got arrested for those murders. But tell us how this massacre led to changes in the gun law in the United States.
Well, the Thompson submachine gun, or the Tommy gun, the Chicago typewriter as it's known, was a weapon of war that was designed to be used in the First World War. It missed the war. The crates were sitting on the dock when the armistice was declared, so it didn't actually get to be used in the trenches. It was the trench broom, they called it, because you could sweep out the trenches with this, as you said, ruthlessly efficient, one of the first, if not the first, submachine guns, portable machine guns. And the company that made it was sort of faced with a problem. If you can't sell it to the military, law enforcement initially didn't want this thing, so they start marketing it as a private defense weapon. And gangsters in Chicago and other cities decide that this is something, it's easily concealed, it's very efficient, it shoots handgun ammunition that is widely available. So this is a great way to protect themselves from all of this competition that's coming in. And so you had a situation in Chicago where, because the Thompson was so new, even though there were laws against carrying handguns concealed, for example, in the city of Chicago, there was no law that said you couldn't walk around with a Thompson submachine gun. So the string of infamous massacres, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre being really the first that sort of brings national attention to this. But there was another one in Kansas City a few years later where some law enforcement officers were killed. That really leads to what is the first federal gun control law in United States history, the National Firearms Act of 1934, that is specifically targeted against these weapons, taking guns like the Thompson submachine gun and also sawed-off shotguns out of the hands of the underworld.
Was it effective?
It was. I mean, it's still to this day in effect, and it's a tax. It's not a ban. But it's still very difficult or at least expensive to get your hands on a Thompson submachine gun.
So tell us, the Tommy guns are in Michigan.
That's right. One of the men who almost certainly was involved in the crime, even though he was not charged, all of the evidence strongly suggests he was there, a fellow by the name of Fred Burke, after the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, hides out in St. Joseph, Michigan. And several months later, in late 1929, he's involved in an altercation with a police officer, kills the officer, and flees again. But the police in St. Joseph, the sheriff's department, go back to the house where Burke had been living. They find this stash of weaponry, including two Thompson submachine guns. And of course, back in Chicago, there had been a great effort to find the weapons that had been used in this crime, to find any evidence that—
Two Tommy guns.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that Capone is involved in this in some respect, but how do you prove it? So they find these guns that had been in the possession of a hitman who was known to be an associate of Capone. They send them to Chicago. And an individual by the name of Calvin Goddard, who is really a pioneer in the use of ballistics and forensic evidence, takes these guns, fires bullets, compares them to the ones found at the scene, and discovers that not only were these guns the ones that were used in the crime, but that one of those weapons had been also used to kill another gangster in New York who Capone had difficulties with. It seems kind of basic now, I think, because we've all seen CSI. We all, you know that you can match bullets taken from a gun to the one that fired it. But back then, this was still a very new thing, and people were, it almost seemed like magic to them that you could, have a crime committed in New York, a crime committed in Chicago, and a crime committed outside St. Joseph, Michigan. And a scientist can compare the bullets and say, this weapon fired all of those bullets.
And the guns are still in St. Joseph, but not in a museum, right?
That's right. They are still held by the sheriff's department that confiscated them because the St. Valentine's Day Massacre is still an open case, as you said. Nobody was charged, but Fred Burke was later arrested, and there was some question over whether he should be charged for this crime or the murder of the officer in Michigan. He was ultimately charged and convicted of that killing and died in prison up in Marquette. But he never copped to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Scarface and the Untouchable, Al Capone, Elliot Ness, and the Battle for Chicago. And we should note, Brad Schwartz will be talking about the book at Literati this coming Friday the 25th, 7 p.m. That should be a lot of fun. Great read. I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing your work with us.
Thank you for having me.